CGM 99.1 FM programming is hosted almost exclusively by community volunteers. The views and opinions expressed on the following program are that of the host and their guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of CGM FM. For more information and resources, visit our website at cjam.ca.
Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CGM's HandyLink. You're listening to HandyLink on CGM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA Windsor on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, Marcia Gregg and Megan Ball Rigdon will be telling us a little bit about the Summit Center. So, can you tell me a little bit about the Summit Center?
Okay, well, the Summit Center for Preschool Children with Autism has been around for 25 years, and we are a applied behavior analysis preschool, and we do diagnostic assessments for autism for preschoolers, and we have two treatment programs, our Unity Parent Training Program and our STEPS program, which is a day program. Meg's very familiar with both of those. We also do a parent support group and workshops and research.
So how do you reach out to the affected community to let them know that there are these programs for children with autism?
Well, that's a great question, Cam, because more and more parents are finding us without us doing as much reaching out as we used to. Our waiting lists are very long for assessments and all our services, longer than I've ever seen it. It's tragic because early intervention is key. But what we do have a Facebook page, more of our referrals now directly just from parents referring themselves, but local community organizations, speech language clinics, children's mental health centers, family physicians and pediatricians refer people to us. But we have the problem where we have way more customers than we can ever serve.
So how does early intervention for a child with autism provide benefits long term?
Do you want to take that one, Meg?
Oh, man. I was going to say I immediately wanted to jump in just because, just the question makes me want to cry. Because when Dr. Gregg first met my little guy, I mean, he had no interest in anyone else. And as his mom, when I was asked if he responded to his name, I said yes without blinking. I thought he did. And then we ran a few quick little tests of someone saying his name and then me saying his name. And me being closer to him and saying it. And he just... It wasn't they didn't hear me. He just genuinely didn't care because he would respond to a loud clap to turn and look at that. And now I have a little guy who converses with me. And, you know, when he has a hard day and stuff goes down at school, we can talk about what led him to do things that maybe other people didn't understand. And he has his feelings and his words and can ask for what he wants. I mean, these were things that when he was diagnosed, I didn't think would be possible, if I'm being completely honest. But we kept working, and I think that's what Unity and STEPS that Summit Center does is so amazing, is it gives you hope and a process to walk forward with.
So
Do you ever encounter any myths or stereotypes concerning autism?
Oh, all the time. I'm sure Meg does too. Many parents tell us that that other professionals, other family members say, don't worry, he'll grow out of it. He'll talk when he's older. That's a myth. Don't wait and see. Ever wait and see. What's your favorite myth, Meg?
Well, I was going to say, actually, another thing a lot of people don't look at girls is potentially having autism. A lot of the times, you know, and especially in older kids, it was looked at as ADHD and other things. So we've certainly, I think, broadened the diagnostic lens in big ways, which has helped. But yes, there are certainly a lot of stigma that, you know, if you are on the spectrum and high functioning, that you could be like Rain Man. And it's like, these are, it is called a spectrum because it is so varied, right? From black to white, from red to purple. It is, we are every, there's everything. And we really have to respect that when we look at treatments and families and what we offer.
So that being said, in your time with these programs through the Summit Center, has there been any success story that stands out for each of you?
Well, I can think of lots and lots of success stories. I'll say one about a little girl that I diagnosed with autism at 23 months. And at that point, she not only really didn't pay any attention to people, but the only thing she'd do with toys was hoard balls. So she would pick up balls until her arms were full of balls, and then she'd just walk around carrying them and getting upset if any fell out. But she if you could put any other toy in her hand, she'd drop it. And if you tried to take one of her balls or play ball with her, that would just get her upset. She wasn't talking. And a few months later, her parent and she attended our community parent training program, which is 12 weeks, 5 mornings a week for 12 weeks, 180 hours. I remember that at first, she didn't like circle time, where kids and adults sit in a circle and they sing songs and read stories and play games. So she wouldn't even go near the circle, and she'd often stand in the corner of the room with her hands over her ears. So her dad said, well, her favorite thing is potato chips. So we broke potato chips up into little pieces, and then as she came a little closer to the circle, he'd give her a piece of potato chip. And her daycare, where she'd been going for a year, said, you can't do that. It's wrong to use foods as positive reinforcement. That's a terrible thing. But she didn't really care about any toys or activities. So he got her coaxed closer and closer until finally she would sit down in the circle for a minute. At the end of 6 weeks, she was sitting in circle for 15 minutes, singing songs, playing games, and interacting with the other children and adults without any potato chips whatsoever. It was just that it was new to her. It was scary. She didn't like it. She never sat in circle at daycare for a whole year. But in 6 weeks, her parent could get her to participate in circle. At the end of the 12-week program, I saw her playing with her grandmother with a dollhouse and pretending a doll was climbing up the stairs. And her grandmother said, 12 weeks ago, she never, ever acknowledged that I existed.
It's amazing. Meg, do you have a story?
I think Meg might have some success stories, too.
Oh, yeah, well, I was going to say, even just the not pretending that you didn't exist, I remember my mom, you know, Grandma, coming to visit the kids and saying, like, oh, no, I totally understand. It always takes a couple of days for them to realize I'm here. And that's, you know, someone who's pretty close and special in their life coming for visits, you know, multiple times a month, usually. So, I can identify with that. But when it comes, I mean, I could talk about how my kids are pretty exceptional. They were diagnosed at level 2 and level 3 with fairly substantial support needs. And, you know, it's amazing. They both are doing emerging literacy stuff, and my little girl just read to her class. But what one thing that always has really stood out in my memory was actually after being through STEPS and Unity. And one spring, my daughter went outside to play, and she just freaked out. And to me, I didn't know why. I didn't know what had suddenly changed. I just knew that suddenly she was going outside, and with her limited words, she was saying, I'm scared, I'm scared. But that was all that she was able to do because she was so upset. And because I had been through STEPS and Unity, I immediately started to think, okay, five senses, what's different right now? Okay, it's spring. It's a lot brighter out here than usual. Okay, she's got her sunglasses, so that's not it. And literally just ran through the senses, and I realized she's not wearing her coat anymore. And she had just been through a unit on bees at school and how they have stingers. And so a fly, not even a bee, had flown by her, but she heard a buzzing sound and didn't have any sort of feeling of protection on herself. She was wearing a little tank top in the spring weather that was nice. And I just remember thinking to myself, thank heavens that I was able to step back and not just be a mom and go, come on, kiddo, let's go outside anyway and drag her out. I was able to take that pause and consider how she's processing things differently than I am. Because, hey, I'm a mom. I'm always cold. I love hot weather. Going outside in a tank top feels great to me. But suddenly to realize she feels vulnerable, man. She just wants to feel a little safer. So we wore a light cotton shirt instead. And that really pretty much solved the problem. And it, you know, it did take me a couple of days to kind of go through all the steps and ease her back into it. But we did. We got over it within about a week. It was intense. But I still think my lucky stars, we had the skill.
Like to thank you both for taking time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
In this segment of our show, Hubert Van Niekerk will be giving us an update on Every Canadian Counts. So what's the latest with Every Canadian Counts?
Well, we are pushing ahead with contacting members of Parliament on a national level and also at the provincial levels. Going to do our best to bring in a national publicly funded disability support program for all persons with long-term and chronic disabilities.
So, you've been pushing a great deal for the insurance plan for everyone with a disability. Have you seen a lot of community support for this effort?
Yes, there was more support when we first started this. Back in around 2016. And then, fortunately or unfortunately, the accessibility agenda became front and center and took up a lot of the, what we call, oxygen in the room for a much more bigger national plan. And currently it's the Canada Disability Benefit Plan that's taking up a lot of time. And that's also at second reading. It's finished second reading at the Senate. So we're looking for that to be approved fairly soon. And we're hoping that the next really big thing for disabled people and persons with disabilities is a publicly funded national disability support plan, so that would basically catch all the rest after the poverty agenda has been sort of satisfied.
So why is ECC making this a priority area? Why does it need to be at the forefront in the minds of those in power?
Well, those in power, and to be honest, the general public, think that persons with disabilities, disabled people, have got what they need, that they're well looked after. And this is quite a fallacy. They're not nearly well looked after. More than around 50% are in poverty and not getting what they need. So even if the Canada Disability Benefit comes in, which we do believe will come in, it's still not going to look after all the other needs that are required for disabled people. And I do use the term disabled people and persons with disabilities kind of hand in hand. They're both somewhat offensive, so I'm trying to use both sides, both terms commonly used.
So, in that sense, are there any steps that the general public can take to get themselves better informed and just better ready to embrace some of these ideals concerning an expanded benefit?
Yeah, the general public really should visit our website for what we're about and what we are doing and how to get there. Our website, of course, is everycanadiancounts.com.
So, do you find when you present these cases to leadership and to the community, are there ever any myths or stereotypes concerning disability?
Yes, I think one of the biggest myths, I believe, is probably ableism, where people think persons with disabilities cannot do the same or more, or at least, are very capable as we all are. So I think ableism is probably the biggest thing to overcome.
Do you have any advice for those who might have that kind of mindset as to how they can kind of veer away from it and recognize persons with disabilities for who they really are?
You know, Cam, it's really difficult because there's persons that do not have disabilities are ableist, and also people with disabilities can be ableist as well. And unless you're in it, you have to check your ableism all the time as an individual to make sure that when you see somebody, you get past the first impression. And keeping in mind also that several disabilities are invisible disabilities. The easiest ones to see are persons in wheelchairs or some other type of disability that's very easily to be seen. But the invisibility of disability is really, really huge. It's large.
So, in your time advocating through Every Canadian Counts, has there been any success moment that stands out for you?
I think we've had quite a few. Mostly when we're talking to members of Parliament, where it's like an aha moment when they realize what we are doing will actually be beneficial, not even just to persons with disabilities, but also their caregivers. And everybody, and that's why we call it Every Canadian Counts, because disabilities affects us all. And it's a way that we can finally take everybody into account that has a long-term chronic disability. So when they see that this is actually a plan that will work, it is an aha moment for several members of Parliament. And keep in mind, too, the way this is funded, sometimes this is actually going to be probably a $35 billion to $40 billion a year plan. And people say, well, that's going to cost us a lot, and it will, but it's deducted as a source deduction from your paycheck. So everybody pays because everybody could need this at any particular time. The disabled is a club that everybody's welcome to. And you just never know when you're going to be invited. So anybody from that's born with a disability or acquire a disability during their life will be covered and get what they need instead of fighting for little pieces of pie that everybody's fighting for now.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Thanks, Cam.
Of course. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Did you know CGEM collaborates with clubs and organizations both on the University of Windsor campus and in the general Windsor Essex community? There are a bunch of different ways your group can collaborate with CGEM to help bring it more attention, but also make your current group project a little easier. We can schedule an interview to help the community learn more about your club or organization. Don't worry, the interview can be pre-recorded, so have no fear of misspeaking. If you're looking for a smaller way to advertise something special with your group, look no further. We can create PSAs for events, fundraisers, volunteer calls, new clubs, and more. We have you covered. Then there's events. If your group is struggling to get everything accounted for with your event, why not collaborate with CGEM? We can help gather volunteers, secure a venue, equipment, catering, and more. Save yourself the stress of setting up your event while creating a new connection. Interested or just have questions? Email us at info.cgmfm@gmail.com. We hope to hear from you soon.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA Windsor on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Marcia Gregg and Megan Ball Rigdon told us a little bit about the Summit Center, and Hubert Van Niekerk told us a little bit about the latest happenings with Every Canadian Counts. In this segment of our show, Richard Dubois will be telling us a little bit about his experience with the Kidney Foundation. So, can you tell me a little bit about your experiences with the Kidney Foundation?
Sure. I'm a kidney patient, and I'm also a volunteer for the Kidney Foundation's peer support program. It's a program that's in place to help people and their families with who are living with kidney disease. And so that brings us to March of this year, and this is Kidney Health Awareness Month, and we're looking to raise funds and awareness for kidney disease for people across Ontario and Canada.
So how does having a peer support group help those who are living with kidney disease? I'd imagine there's a mental health aspect to knowing there are going to be day-to-day complications.
Yeah, that's exactly correct. When you have kidney disease, for a lot of people, they don't know early on in life that they have kidney disease. It's sometimes called an invisible disease. But when the symptoms start to manifest, you can encounter quite a few day-to-day challenges as you progress towards possibly losing kidney function. And so the peer support volunteer group exists to help people sort of navigate their day-to-day lives, how to manage things like diet and exercise, but also how to manage, visiting, going to clinics and speaking with health professionals, and basically just to have people to talk to who understand the experiences they're having and who have also been there and who have some insight to share on what might come next.
So, in your work, do you ever encounter any myths or stereotypes concerning kidney disease?
Sometimes. I think what you encounter most often are just some misconceptions about health in general. Misconceptions about diet and, what you should or shouldn't eat, or sometimes people being a little skeptical of medical professionals, those sort of things. Our goal with peer support is to simply provide some clarification and sort of to dismiss some information that people might have encountered by Googling and looking online that may not be entirely accurate. For the most part, I think people who take advantage of the Peer Support Foundation are really there to ask questions. They're just uncertain about things. And so instead of leaving them to their own devices to go down an incorrect path, we sort of try to help them, point them in the right direction and figure out who they should be asking questions and where to get good information.
So how does the group reach out to the affected population to let them know there is support for kidney patients?
Well, the Kidney Foundation, one of its many functions is to raise awareness about kidney disease, which includes letting people know about the peer support group. Kidney disease affects a lot of Canadians. There are about 4 million Canadians, 1 in 10, who have kidney disease, and a great many of them don't even know it. So our goal is to simply raise that awareness and raise awareness about your health overall, but also to let people know that if something is not right, if you're not feeling well, it's worth checking with your doctor to see if there's something going on that may be kidney-related. It's a more common disease than most people realize. I'm an unusual case in that I was diagnosed with my kidney disease when I was very, very young. I was in grade school, and I had some symptoms manifest very early on with hearing and vision, and I had some gastric problems. And so that was a suspicious situation, and sure enough, it turned out to be my kidneys weren't working properly. But a lot of people will make it into adulthood not knowing they have a problem. So this just gives people that information. It's just a way of letting people know that kidney disease is a thing, and it's a little more common than I think most people realize.
So in your time providing support to kidney patients and offering your own experience as a sounding board, has there been any success story that stands out for you?
I think that, I've been a volunteer with the Kidney Foundation for a long time, I think over 20 years. I used to live in Toronto when the peer support program was in its infancy. And it just happened, I had one of my transplants in Toronto. It's turning 18 next month, too, so I've had this transplant for a long time. And because I lived in downtown Toronto, I was very close to the Toronto General Hospital. So I could conveniently just walk there. And as part of my volunteering, I would occasionally get a phone call from someone at the Kidney Foundation asking if I wouldn't mind going down to the hospital to meet with a patient or a patient and that patient's family. And if I could, I would. I was very happy to do that because they just, every time I'd meet with someone, I could tell when they would leave that they had a small sense of relief, that some of the uncertainty was taken away. There's one family I remember particularly, they came from Barrie, Ontario, and they had to travel down to Toronto because they have a really good nephrology program. That's sort of the science of medicine for kidneys at the Toronto General. And I just remember it was a young man and his wife, and they had two young kids with them. And they really didn't know anything, which is perfectly understandable, but they didn't know that much about kidney function and what kidneys do, and it was a very scary experience for them. But after meeting them, I could tell that just sharing my experiences with them made them feel a lot less scared. And that's when I knew I was doing something worthwhile. It was nice to know that they left their clinic not being so overwhelmed and not being so worried about their future. I mean, they had a long road ahead, but it wasn't so mysterious after that.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
You bet.
Thanks.
My friends, what Hubert was describing in his interview is a mass undertaking, and it probably sounds to most of us like an incredible financial commitment. But I maintain to you, when it comes to the quality of life that a person with a disability might enjoy, there is no way to measure the cost. For the fact is, a person with a disability should have the same right to access as anyone else in society. I'm familiar with the model they're using. It's based on the Australian NDIS, which actually worked quite well. It allowed their citizens to have more options and more flexibility. Just a chance to feel that they counted. The fact of having a better insurance option, the capability, not having so much financial strain on them, it's definitely something a lot of people with disabilities are constantly working towards. Not just them, their families, caregivers, friends. It does take an entire community to stand with a person with a disability. But I maintain that the end result, what you gain from the experience, can't be measured in any way. It is beyond words and beyond a gift to the person standing with them. For in learning about someone with a disability, you learn about yourself. You learn that human strength is far more than we ever give it credit for. We come to realize the world is not so superficial a place as we sometimes tend to think. There's so many layers of different types of people, different ability levels. That's a beautiful thing. People come together, play off each other's abilities, and be a place where people with disabilities can recognize that they matter, they count, and we're not going to let something as paltry as our own fear of what it might cost us keep them from having the best chance at a full, rich, meaningful life. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal, so get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.